appreciate being able to talk about some of the things that we're doing in Texas and the situation that we have there. And Rob introduced some of the issues that we're facing as well. I want to thank my co-authors, J.P. Nico and Bridget Scanlon, who have been spending a lot of time in this issue for the last several years. And so the real question then is, you know, why would we want to study the water, land, and the energy nexus? And we're really looking at this as sort of an integrated system that it takes a certain amount of water to get energy, it requires a certain amount of energy to provide the water, and all the land footprint that's associated with it. So these are things that we're looking at across the state. It's obviously, it's a huge national issue right now, so it's great to have a special symposium at the soils meeting on this topic, and you see the graph on the top right is just oil production in the United States, and this has wide-ranging impacts both geopolitically as well as within the U.S., so there's some real positive aspects to it, and the red line is Texas, and Texas is happy about that because it brings in about $35 billion a year in severance. For the state's economy. So there's good there, and then there's, of course, then we have the scary graph on the bottom, which is the drought of record in 2011, which had 98% of the state in an extreme or exceptional drought. And so you take this sort of increase in oil and gas activity at the same time on the one hand, and then you link it with obvious shortages of water across the state, and which we are, and we try to balance these resources in a way that makes sense for a state that's going to double in population in the next 30 to 40 years. And so we're really trying to kind of understand this and to make it essentially sustainable. And so these are the energy plays. They're called plays. I put that in quotes. I don't know who cooked that one up, but it's but these are all the wells that are drilled in the state, and the really large ones here, if I can get this pen to work, is the Permian Basin, Eagle Ford, and the Barnett, and then there's the Haynesville, Texas, and it basically crosses state borders, and then there's the Marmaton. And the graphs basically show the difference between the tight oil, the tight gas, and the shales. And our focus has pretty much been on the big three, the Barnett, which is the oldest play in the country, the Eagle Ford and the Permian Basin, which are now the largest oil producers in the U.S. And most of, and I'm sure this is similar elsewhere, most of the dry gas drilling and activity is essentially stopped because the gas, collapsing gas prices a few years ago. There's a whole plethora of things that we can talk about in terms of environmental impact, and without making any, no bones about it, it's an industrial process, and it's a diffuse industrial process that basically crawls across the landscape. So there's a whole bunch of things that could be an issue, everything from, really sort of the traffic and noise and dust that was brought up before, all the groundwater and the surface water impacts. And what I want to do is I just put circles around the sort of the land fragmentation, which I'll talk about, which we're finishing up a study, and some of the things on the groundwater and the surface water. It's important, I think, to put into context the amount of water that's actually being used for this process. If the total amount of water, and this is a scaling issue as Rob mentioned, the total amount of water that's used in the state of Texas is about 18 million acre feet. And the amount of water that's used for oil and gas activity statewide is less than 0.5% of the total. If you just look at the Barnett, most of the water that's used is for landscape irrigation and crop irrigation. About 80% or more of the water is being used for that. This graph, which was published in 2012 by JP and Bridget, basically just shows what we sort of expect the total footprint, the total water footprint, in megacubic, million cubic meters here on the right, to what that's going to look like, and on the left, right, and on the right is in thousands of acre feet, and so these graphs are out of date the moment you publish them, right? Because this process is so incredibly price dependent that as soon as it comes out of press, even with the S&T, the gas things shift a lot. So the rig counts are just moving around the state. It's like an amoeba that's basically moving from place to place. And so it turns out that the total water use is really still about 130, maybe 100,000 acre feet a year across the state. And so what's happened is that the Barnett has dropped and Eagle Ford has gone up. And so they've basically counteracted each other at about 50,000 acre feet per year. If we just look at the water use, and this is a geology issue, there's a lot of really interesting science that can be done on these things. You see this huge variability. This is the amount of water it takes to break the rock. And this is the cumulative water use, and so here we're looking basically this line right here, which you can barely see with the black triangle, is about 5 million gallons a well. It's about what the mean is. And although it has been going up, it's because the laterals themselves are getting longer. So initially, the companies would basically drill short laterals with maybe horizontal lengths with 4 or 5 laterals, and now they're going to 20 and 30 and 40 laterals. And so the total amount of water increases, but what we found is that the amount of water per frac foot has not changed in the last 10 years. It's about 1,000 gallons per frac foot. So so how they actually go about breaking the rock hasn't really changed that much. What has happened is that the way that the water is injected has changed, and that's made the rocks break more effectively so that they can get higher oil and gas. And that's helpful because it ultimately uses less water. And there's a lot of discussion about flowback, and I think that this is one of the really big issues and one of the big differences between Pennsylvania and Texas. So Pennsylvania, I think, has 4 or 5 deep well injections that have been permitted in the state, and Texas has 35,000. 7,000 wells in the state are operating right now for deep well injection, and the other 28,000 are used for recirculating wells for essentially secondary water floods for oil and gas, for conventional oil and gas reservoirs. So this is something that Texas has been doing for a long time, of all the wells that are disposed, I think it's probably a very small handful that have exhibited some problems. There's issues with induced seismicity, particularly in Oklahoma, which has not come up. Oklahoma has a scary number of earthquakes that are felt earthquakes. It's somewhere on the order of 2 to 3 per day now. They don't really understand what's causing that. Texas, thankfully, is not in first place when it comes to Oklahoma. This is one of the things we don't want to be in first place. But this is the amount of water that's actually coming back. And this is similar to a decline curve, an energy decline curve, that you're going to see on a per well basis. And Rob was talking about the EUR. And what can we expect to get out of each well, and what would be the water footprint or the water intensity of somewhere on the order of about 7 cubic meters per terajoule or 7 liters per gigajoule. And that's about the numbers that we've seen for most of the plays in the state. And when you really look at this flowback water, you see these numbers here, 0.64, and that's an acre feet. Okay, and these are the number of months after the well has been opened up. So you see a rapid decline. Some wells are producing a lot of water. In fact, most of the operators would say that they're essentially water companies before they are energy companies. And these are the number of wells that accounts for. And if you start to sum all those up, is when you really have an opportunity to try to manage the water on an integrated basis. The water at half of an acre foot over a period of years is so small that you can't manage, you can't really use that water for a lot of beneficial use, and you have to truck it around and you have to store it, and that adds risk, environmental risk, by doing that, which is why there's so much water that's disposed of in Texas, because it's actually safer to simply get rid of the water than it is to store it, treat it, and reuse it. And we're doing a lot of work to try to see if there's a way to sort of gather all the water from specific wells or well areas so that the water can be used for refracking. Halliburton now fracks wells at 300,000 parts per million TDS, so it's a very, very salty water that they can reuse to avoid any freshwater impact. So this graph here shows essentially the percentage of flowback versus the water that would use in injection. And you're looking at the blue line here is the mean, and we're looking at about 150% of the water in the Barnett is essentially coming back. So these are essentially water wells that also produce some gas. And if we look at the Eagle Ford, which is the other play, this is how much water is being used, and these numbers are a little bit dated, so this thing goes way up here, and 2014 goes like way up there. But we're still looking at about 5 million gallons a well. If we look at the disposal, here are all the disposal wells in the state. This is data that takes a tremendous amount of time to gather because we have to collect it from multiple databases, from IHS and Drilling Info and Railroad Commission and all these places, and then unify all the units and unify the numbers to make sure there's no obvious outliers. And when you do that, you really get a sense of, okay, what's the distribution of the disposal wells, and how can we better place the water management components of oil and gas activity to where the energy production is occurring. So each one of these bubbles, you know, you see this is relatively diffuse. Each one of these bubbles is, I think it's 1.75 million gallons per year is each one of the big bubbles, right? So that's like the big one. And what we found in the Barnett is that it tends to be much more concentrated over two or three counties. So in the Eagle Ford, it's much more diffuse, and this probably has some impact in terms of just sort of safety and reducing road traffic and reducing pipeline and disturbance, things like that. And of course, when you scale everything, right, you can make statistics live for you. We all know that. And it's when you scale down the amount of water that's being used per community, it really starts to become more important. And so this is a graph that shows the county population in Texas versus the fraction of water use as a percent of 2008 water use. And what you see, the black dots are the Barnett, right? It's very, very small. It's less than a half a percent because Dallas uses so much water for irrigating turf, it's crazy. So all that water is basically evaporating and going over to Louisiana and raining on Louisiana, not on Texas. Now, when you start looking at the green dots, you're looking at as much water being used for energy production as it is for all the water used in these smaller communities. And that's an area of concern. And this is no doubt the operators and the researchers are trying to reduce the amount of fresh water use to do these things. And kind of stepping back a little bit and looking at the landscape fragmentation, which is some other work I'm doing with a master's student. This is just a picture from Google Earth that I shamelessly took. And you can see each one of these little white squares is a drilling pad. If you were to look at this in the Permian Basin, it'd just blow your mind how many pads there are. It's crazy. It's crazy, absolutely crazy how many. This is 1 mile, so you can get a sense of what the distribution is. We want to know whether or not if exploration and production, as this kind of rolls out across the play, is this going to have an impact on the really larger core areas of the semi-arid steppe? What effect is that going to have on species distribution, on hydrologic fragmentation, on dust emission potential, on all of these things? Something that has not been studied, and in fact, there is no state agency in the state of Texas that even regulates this, if you can believe it. And so we're just sort of looking at this, trying to gather all the data and get a sense of what this is. And we used a series of both NLCD, National Land Classification Database, and MAP imagery from the USDA so that we can get baseline land disturbance prior to the Eagle Ford beginning its horizontal and the horizontal drilling. We then overlaid all the pipelines, all the drilling pads, all of the injection pads, and then we reclassified everything based on disturbed versus undisturbed, looked to see how many of the disturbed areas were in sort of these core areas that are greater than 2 kilometers square, which we're considering a core area. We can make it anything we want. And then we get a chance to see whether or not the infrastructure that's being developed in this very rural area is really starting to chew up these large cores. And so this bar graph basically shows, there's the red bar that shows the pre-Eagle Ford, right? And this is pre-Eagle Ford pre-2001. And you can see this is the core, the three different core areas of different sizes, and then we have perforated, which is basically a drill pad in the middle of a core. We have edges, which of course is the edge of a core, and then we have patches, which are essentially non-core areas inside of a large area disturbed. And we have basically nothing there. And as we start going with production pads, with production and injection wells, there's very little change and impact because it's really just it's maybe a 5-acre plot of land over an entire part of South Texas. It's pretty small. But when you start looking at the pipelines, now you're looking at large linear features with 50 to 100 meter set asides where the land is essentially disturbed. And what we're trying to do is sort of work on how to reduce that impact so it's only disturbed one time and the operators are able to continue their operations. And so just to kind of finish up, looking at this from, at least in the state of Texas, we really are trying to look at this as an integrated system. The operators have a legal right to operate. They're loosely regulated in the state for sure. And so we want to try to get ahead of this because the Eagle Ford is only about 5% drilled out. So there's 6,000 wells now. It's probably going to go up to 60,000 wells. And it's going to be drilling at this level of intensity for the next 20 years. So getting ahead of this now and just trying to constrain how the operators are doing business allows us to reduce what that impact is going to be. Water stress is important. Droughts are essentially difficult to predict. Impacts are difficult to manage. The state's going to be 6 million acre feet short of water in 2050. They're trying to improve the situation. And really thinking long-term, these landscape impacts, I think, personally, could be just as important as the water impacts, if not more important, because you're going to get into community fatigue, you're going to get into road damage, you're going to get into all of these other things that are that become an issue. And that better data analyses by this community is what we really need to help stakeholders make these wise decisions. And with that, it's lunchtime, and but I'll take any questions if you got. Yeah.
I'm just surprised to see that many well pads, you know, because if you're, you know, do 6 to 8 wells per pad, you know, on an 8,000 foot lateral, that's about maybe a square mile or something out of one.
Yeah. So the reason for that, and this is a this is a deeper legal issue, is that the companies have to drill at least one well on a lease block in order to hold the lease. They have to do it within 3 years.
Right.
So what they'll do is they'll build a pad, they'll drill one well, and then they'll go to the next, now they hold the lease, essentially in perpetuity, then they'll move to the next pad. So it's not that they're drilling 8 or 10 wells on one pad, then going to the next pad, then the next pad. They're essentially starting off by doing pad construction, then drilling one well, and then eventually adding the wells later on. So on average, there's less than 2 wells per pad in the Eagle Ford right now. But in the Barnett, like right underneath the UT Dallas campus, there's one pad that has 18 laterals. Going right off this one.
But even then, you know, if they do a pre-planning, you know, they, you know, I don't think we have that within a mile distance. You know, we have 2 pads in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
So that's a surprise, because you know you're drilling well pads, the laterals that are like maybe 2 miles long. You know, so why would you put 2 pads that are, you know, within a half a mile of each other? You know, I don't.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. All the laterals are basically oriented northwest, southeast, and so they're basically marching them across laterally. So when you look at where the wells are closer, they tend to be linear going east-west, right? Not north-south. So and so you'd have to really, you know, you'd kind of analyze this on, you could just kind of look at it on Google, and you'll see that they follow these property lines. Mostly east-west is where they're closer together. But they're typically using, you know, 600-foot spacings between pads. So it's not uncommon to use that level. For a typical medium-sized ranch, that might be a 15,000-acre ranch, they might have 100 drill pads on a 15,000-acre ranch.